Let me say a few words then about support structures for leaders, because as soon as you get this thing going, you are going to need support structures. Because once it takes off, within 2 years anyway, you should have, you know, 8 small groups at a minimum going in a larger church. In a smaller church, it is slower. You don't begin to have this kind of growth. You're not looking for it. If you can get 3 small groups going, you know, and 1 or 2 others grow out of those in a smaller church, you have done very, very well. In a larger church, you have more potential and more people that you have to be reaching, so you have greater needs. In stage 1 of the church life, when you have groups and other structures, then let's suppose that you're working with a church school class. You have a Sunday school, Sabbath school class, and you have the pastor or a teacher in that particular class, and you want to have small groups in that class. Even in that setting, you will want to have a layperson as a small group coordinator. And that layperson's tasks are pretty simple in this structure, because that coordinator makes arrangements. Do we need any particular setups or things to have the small groups work? Helps make sure people get into the right kinds of small groups, encourages people, and does any simple problem solving at this stage. Now, let me mention one additional stage. That is if you have a Sunday morning class and you're doing small groups in the class. But one of the very best ways to build small groups in a church which has a fellowship class orientation, if you have that kind of a traditional church structure where your Sunday school has adults in it who are organized around fellowship group principles, is to build small groups right out of the fellowship class. And at Lake Avenue now, they need to redo it again because it's kind of petered down. But for years, that's what they have been doing. They'll take their Sunday morning classes. They'll have a class of, typically those classes will start at 60 and grow to about 200 before they spin off another class. And out of each of those classes then, they will begin small groups, which are standalone small groups. But there is a coordinator. And so Sunday morning announcements can be made about the small groups that are part of this class. People can sign up. You know, there's a place to check in week by week in terms of what's going on in the small groups. If you've got that kind of structure in your church, it's the easiest way to start spinning small groups out of that, because they already have a rationale for being together. And many people will respond if you just build on the commitments they have already made and give them the opportunity for one more level of involvement. But to stay with the coordinator thing for a moment, if you train all men, my experience has been, and in other churches as well, the coordinators are very often women. Women who are not working outside the home, who have more time, who are available. Now, with the changing patterns of work, you know, this is shifting. But my experience has been women as coordinators or couples as coordinators, and only in our men's group have we had men, you know, just as coordinators, because of the time that it takes to be a coordinator, availability, and those kinds of things. So if you just do all male kinds of things, you better look and make sure that there's some men in that group who have time that they will commit. You better not have all workaholics who are squeezing this group in and really can't carve out any time, because you won't get coordinators out of that particular structure. You want to look for somebody who's got a little flex in their life, so that they can take on, grow into some of these kinds of functions. That might just bring me to say there are a couple of common assumptions people make. Women can't train men, wrong. You got to be a couple to train couples, wrong. You don't have to be, it's a training group. Yeah. And I have a personal rule that I've evolved over many years, which is that I never take my spouse along just in order to fulfill the role of spouse. If it's going to be meaningful, you know, and a good experience, and it's something my spouse wants to do for his own well-being, then fantastic. But because I want to do training, and it's a couples group, I don't have to make my spouse come and be with me in the couples group in order for me to be effective as a trainer in that couples group. And I don't think, I know it is not just true for me as a woman, it is also true for men. Better not to have your spouse there if it's not going to be helpful to your spouse and something your spouse really is choosing to do. You are in there as a trainer. You are not in there necessarily as a couple. Married people can train singles. Singles can train married people. You know, those kinds of stereotype assumptions don't follow. What you really need is the right heart and the willingness to work and some of the gifts. So stage 2 groups then, for structures, you have groups are standing alone now, a pastor trainer is working with a model group, out of the model group, I try to ask one of the persons to be a coordinator when we start our first level of model groups, and they're only coordinating with three groups, and it's quite easy to do. So they grow into the job gradually, and they grow with the job grows. So as those groups grow, you know, they're training eight, or they're coordinating with eight kind of people. But if they started small, it was very doable, manageable kind of task. So I look for a coordinator just as soon as I have multiple small groups. And the coordinator, then one of the things that we try to do is to make sure that there is a contact person in each small group. Usually that's the designated leader. But there is at least a person who is designated, you know, as the contact person for the coordinator to be talking to. And that person gives a report on what's happening in the group, and the coordinator knows who to call inside the group. And as I said, usually that's a designated leader, but not always. Okay, and you can see some of the things that the person does there. When the church gets gigantic, you end up having a pastor or a staff person who serves at least half time as the director of small group ministries. And one of the things that I have identified in looking at large, successful churches in small groups is whether or not there is someone who spends at least half of their time just working the small group. If that person, typically a church will say, I want a pastor who will work in small groups, but then the job description of that pastor is such that they only have perhaps 10% of their time available to work with the small groups. In a large church with a complex structure, that is not adequate time. And I've noticed the difference between large churches where small groups were in somebody's job description and large churches where somebody was working with small groups day in, day out, being in touch with people, problem solving, praying, working, training, thinking of new things to do, staying on top of it. And that seems to be the difference in terms of a dynamic ongoing growth, is the amount of serious attention this area of the church's life gets paid. So far, I'm not seeing any exceptions to that. I just come back from a church in which I noticed something that I'm wondering about, and I'm going to go check it. There was a pastor whose task it is to be in charge of small groups, and he works it hard, but alongside of him, there is a woman who is working the small groups, and she's handling all the details, and she's staying on top of all the logistics and all the details of that particular kind of thing. And as I watched her working, they hadn't told me about her before I got there, I started to go back and analyze. And as I did my reviewing, in the large churches that had been successful, they'd always had a woman like that. No matter who had the official label of being in charge of small groups, there was a woman in there who didn't mind doing details, who would work it, you know, all day long and get on the telephone and make those phone calls and keep the list and provide the information and really work that thing. And so the hypothesis I'm testing out now is that that's the hidden person in all of our structures. And that woman almost always, always, is a lay woman who has emerged out of that congregation. She's not a paid staff person. Lots of pastors say to me, give me the name of somebody I can hire as a small group person. It's entirely possible that God has somebody sitting in your congregation who is going to do a better job, because this will be the center of their life. And they won't be doing 50 million other tasks. And they will be doing this, you know, as their calling. And that might be, you know, one of the things that God would do in your situation. I'm going to keep looking at that to see whether that hypothesis runs true across the board. But so far, I'm seeming to notice that. It is an advanced small group coordinator. And the person usually emerges right out of a small group coordinator kind of thing. And it turns out they had a gift for organization. And you know, and they just found it a joy to do these kinds of things. Did I tell you about this one church where the gal's husband is a computer programmer, and they wrote a computer program, and they keep all the people, they have 1,000 people in small groups, they keep them all on the computer program. And the group leaders are required, the contact person out of each group, is required to submit a list of the names of everyone who is in the group at monthly kinds of intervals, and people who have been absent over the last month. And they know within a month every single person. Then they have this person with a group of lay people whose task it is to contact all the people who've dropped out of groups over the last month and find out why. Do they need a new group? Are they disaffected with the conflict they didn't work through? Yeah. And it's no wonder that program is growing. Somebody is paying attention to what is happening. They're not just hoping and assuming. They are monitoring that thing. At this stage, though, when it gets really monstrous, then you do need to have an overall, not simply a coordinator, you know, but you need a coordinator of coordinators. And you may need a small group council or a mission group whose task it is to pray, strategize, work through what are we going to do in small groups. This is the ministry team, as I was talking about it in the other day. But each of those persons, it's best to have on that council people who are involved as coordinators in small groups, so that there are people who are actually in the work, not just people who are not deep in the structure in terms of what is happening, so that they have the detailed information, what's going on in their one small group, they have the general information of what's happening in the groups they're coordinating, and they bring that to this group then, and they pray as a whole and strategize with a pastor, director of group ministry for future ways to go. In a large church, you have got to have some kind of a structure like this. The danger is to have too many meetings that aren't really helpful, and it's possible to have this kind of group if things are going along fairly healthily, to meet on a quarterly basis and have a longer time of meeting, say to meet for most of a Saturday, one day every quarter, rather than two-hour meetings, once a month, which may not be the most helpful types of things. It depends on, if you're in a crisis, this group might be meeting weekly in order to pray and work through the particular problem as it has emerged. The danger is, don't try to tie people up in too many meetings and too many layers of structure. Make sure the structure is supportive and responsive to their needs, that you're not just doing it for drill. Don't put this in place till you have to have it. But if you get large enough, you have to have it. But you should always, no matter how small the church is, you should have one layperson who has this particular ministry. It's helpful if this layperson can get elected to the governing board, so that you are having an official connection of some type in the governing board, and that small groups are not off to one side. You really need to have multiple people that you are training in. In mobile churches, and some of you wish you had this problem, but in mobile churches, you need a philosophy which says we are training for the world, because you can count on it. Every person that I have brought all the way through to be a sharp coordinator has been transferred. And just about the time that I have them at peak performance, you know, they get transferred. But God has taught me, you know, that we're in the leadership development business, and He needs leaders for His church. And so they're a gift that we give somewhere else, but it means we've got to keep people in the pipeline. But I now plan in my training for mobility. I just have to build it in as a factor. You pour all your eggs into four people, and one of them gets cancer, and two of them get divorced, and one gets transferred to Tallahassee, you know, and you're set back for several years. So you just have to think about what actually happens in people's lives and build that in as you're going. People trained in the model group tend not to cycle out. They regroup and they start new things, and they become leaders in different ways in the congregation. They may not stay exactly in the program in just the same way, but people trained in model groups tend to stay permanently involved in some kind of small group experience, and usually in some kind of leadership capacity. And that's interesting for me to see. I'm just, you know, when I first came to Fuller and started to actually formalize some of these kinds of things, a lot of the stuff I was just doing, you know, and when I started to formalize it and then go back and look, you know, at four different congregations where I'd used the model and start finding who was still functioning in those kinds of places and discovered, well, you know, people I'd done short-term training with, nothing like that. People I'd been in model groups with, we had those kinds of results. And just to the NAV guys here, no, to go back, it's the model of discipling. You know, that what you really do is build yourself into the lives of some people, and once that has happened, it doesn't get unbuilt. It becomes a permanent thing. But they may not stay in your structure. You know, they may grow right out of it, but they do stay in significant kinds of things in the Lord's work. Remember, any time you develop leadership, you're not just developing it for a particular program. You are developing it for the whole church. And you are not sorry if someone doesn't keep working in one particular program if they move into. We looked at one time in Seattle at our session, after we'd been doing small groups for a number of years, and we found over 50% of our elders had emerged out of our small group structures, and they were serving the church in that way, rather than, you know, within that small group structure. But they stayed in their small groups. They wouldn't give it up. It's quite possible in some churches, larger churches particularly, to have two different ways of seeing the congregation. And the two different ways of seeing the congregation are not labeled in anybody's head. These just are kind of patterned responses that we have been taught or reinforced in. And one way is to see the congregation institutionally, and the other is to see the congregation relationally. And when you look at a congregation institutionally, you tend to look at the formal power structure and the formal organization structure of the church. So you're aware of the board and the pastors and the committees and the people who are in your program. And one of the things that you ask about people is, are they coming to the program? That kind of thing. And the task from the institutional side of things is to set up and run the program and get people into the program. And that's a way of thinking when you come institutionally. And whether we label it or not, when we think of a church institutionally, we tend to think of it hierarchically, who's responsible for, you know, the program. And we're very programmatic in our focus. When you look at a congregation relationally, you ask the question of who is connecting to whom and what are they experiencing in terms of their relationships within this congregation. And the task from the standpoint of the person who is very relationally oriented is to help people feel cared for and to express caring, to build the networks of relationships. And people who see with relational eyes will tend to see, you know, who's connected to whom. So you may have, here's one network, here's your couples groups, and you've got a bunch of couples groups, and those are in one kind of network. And over here, you've got the Women's Association. And over here, you have, here's a bunch of committees that are alongside of each other and never interact very much with each other. And you're just looking at different ways in which people come together. And when you look relationally, you see the board as simply one more kind of a relationship that people have with each other, not necessarily in this institutional kind of way of coming at it. The difficulty here is that if you are unwise and you come into a congregation with relational community-building kinds of eyes and you start to develop these kinds of programs and emphases, that it's quite possible to end up with two congregations with contradictory goals. The small group people will have positive relationships, but very little buy-in to the institutional goal. And the institutional people who are overworked and feel uncared for and become critical of the selfish small group people. They are highly committed to institutional goals and consider the relational goals self-centered, koinonia-itis, and some of those kinds of things. They're opposed to starting more small groups because we need workers in the church school, and we need people to sing in the choir, and we need some tasks to get done in this church. As I have examined this phenomenon, particularly in larger churches, I have discovered that very often you have different kinds of people in the two structures, that there is a generation gap that is present in our churches, in this culture anyway. And some of the characteristics would be that very often this group is older and this group will be younger. And I would draw that dividing line somewhere around 50 now. These people are duty people. And the language of duty and loyalty is important language to them. Those words mean something. And people in the relational networks are not so much duty people as fulfillment people. And they will use language of finding and using my gift. And they will use language of becoming what God has meant me to be. And the labels of loyalty and duty are simply not powerful motivators for them. It's not the drum that they march to. They march to a different kind of drum. What is meaningful for me? What gives significance to my life? Etc., those kinds of things. For people on this side of things, very often their needs are being met in the institution through the opportunity to exercise power and influence. So that their needs are being met, but the needs that are being met for them are the needs to be the ones who are decision makers, opinion leaders with power and influence in this setting. Over on this side of things, needs that people are perceiving for themselves are not through the opportunity to have power, but the opportunity to be in meaningful relationships, to know people, to build communities, and often do not see the particular institutional emphases as very pertinent to where their concerns and needs are coming from. Now, left all alone, this is a very dangerous situation, and it's really not acceptable. In the extreme, it is possible that what you could have over here with a high relationship focus and over here are spiritual monsters, distorted people rather than whole in Christ. On this side, it's possible that you can have all kinds of good feelings, but very little ministry if that is emerging. But it's quite possible over on the institutional side that you will have people who are burned out, disillusioned, tired, because they have given but not been given to, and have not been nourished in their relationships. A rather caricature example would be the typical finance chairman of most churches, who is a person absolutely essential to the health and well-being of the church, but seldom loved, seldom receiving lots of strokes and warmth from people around him. You get teachers in the church school who've never been ministered to. You get the cynical choir members. You get the deacons who gossip and get hurt because they have been giving and giving and giving, but there is no pattern of receiving in an interpersonal kind of way which keeps nourishing them. The challenge on both sides of this continuum, and for a pastor working with both sides, is that for those who are relationally oriented, I have found it to be true, contrary to the literature, that people seldom spontaneously erupt into mission. They don't meet for a whole bunch of weeks and have a great time of fellowship and then all of a sudden look at each other and say, now how should we be servants of Jesus Christ and give ourselves away here? That happens sometimes, but that is not the normal pattern. If you simply start fellowship groups or growth groups or care groups, if you have not built ministry in from the beginning as one of the things that we are about, it gets difficult to add it in later on. Now, it doesn't have to be there in a full-blown kind of focus, but when you are training leaders in the model group, see, there's ministry there because they're going to be involved in a ministry of building other small groups. Yeah, but you need to build in, as you're talking about covenants and contracts, that's why I talk about with a discipleship focus, that there is an obedience to Jesus Christ which is implicit in the heart of our contract, explicit at the heart of our covenant with each other, so that ministry is there. One of the things that is quite difficult to do, I'm almost willing to say impossible, is that you can't take a relational network of people, as so often institutional types want to do, and impose on them institutional tasks and commitments. From your group reading, now you ought to know why that doesn't work. Because it comes to them as extraneous. In one church recently, they were asking me why it wasn't working for them to come up with a list of service projects, and then they would send that list of service projects to all their small groups and ask each small group to adopt the service project. It didn't work because the thinking behind it was programmatic instead of organic. And the feeling was these people ought to support the program. One elder came to me once, a missions chairman. He wanted me to send a message to all the small groups that they should attend a certain missions program and that they ought to adopt a missionary in each of those small groups because that's the way we were going to get the missions concern done. The result, if I had done that, would have been intense hostility to the missions program. It would have been exactly counterproductive, because when you impose things on a group which comes as a feeling of attack on our own commitments and values which we have adopted, the group then coheres against the outside influence. So very often these people don't have any understanding of how things work. I'm not telling you that it ought to be that way. I am just telling you that it is that way. So that if you want ministry, mission, task adoption on the part of small groups, they have to covenant to do that. So that you may, in your leadership training, in your training conference, in your workshops, and those kinds of things, help leaders to introduce the idea of what kind of ministry would we like to adopt as a small group, as a covenant question, now, a contracting question that gets worked on in that type of setting. Then it's possible to provide alternatives that people wrestle with and think about and make decisions about, but they have the freedom to work on that themselves. When you impose a mission on them, they will do it in the most token of fashion, and most of the time they won't do it at all. But you build it into the contracting process, and then you have some possibilities, etc., they are more likely to respond to that kind of need. The other thing is that very often in this process, that in any given small group, after they've been together for a while, that there are concerns within that small group in which you have a spark or an ember that could be fanned into the flame of a mission. People are praying about a particular concern, and they could take that concern and do something with that in a more significant way. And in fact, God will have more missions for your church than you ever dreamed of if those beginning embryonic desires, concerns, needs are brought to some kind of fulfillment by using a mission group kind of a structure. The challenge then on this side is to build in from the beginning and work into your training structures contracting issues that have to do with ministry and teaching that has to do with the fact that we are called to be servants of Christ. But then you are allowing people to have the freedom to wrestle through, in what particular way am I going to fulfill that kind of call. But on the other side, and that's where I want to focus, because we've talked a lot about this, I want to focus about on this side for a few moments. The challenge is to help these kinds of persons. And one of the things I realized some years back was that I was quite concerned about some of these groups not being as ministry-centered, because I had not worked that in the beginning stages of things and realized that I needed to change what I was doing. But that God had given a group of people who were task-centered. That group of people were in this structure. They were the kind of people who saw a challenge and committed to a task and worked hard for that. But so the need on this side was not to devalue, you know, those commitments and their willingness to do those things. My goodness, if somebody doesn't, think of all the needs that are not going to be met. We need this kind of thing. But the challenge was to help the people who are functioning institutionally to experience genuine Christian community as they do that. So that as they are in those institutional structures, they are being cared for. They are being supported. There is personal nurturing that is happening. In other words, we quit using them and start building them, encouraging them, supporting them in what we are doing. Now, at the heart of that, then, is the issue of committees. Because institutionally, we don't function as small groups, we function as committees. And so, at a central issue, you have to wrestle through the question of the committee and the board as a Christian community. Is it possible? The answer is yes. Is it difficult? In some situations, extremely difficult. Does it have to be done? Yes, it does have to be done. Because if you do not work with your board and your official committees and your structures, you will split your church down the road. It may not physically split, but it will be two congregations emotionally distanced from each other. I don't have time to go through everything that's on that chart, but you do want to have a look at that to see the difference between a committee and the community, because what you want to do is, to the greatest extent possible, and sometimes it'll be very small and sometimes it'll be quite great, start moving committees into caring communities. Bottom line assumption that I make is that biblically, God has called us to be in community. He didn't call us to be in committee. And when we function as a committee, we are not excused from the demands of the gospel to fulfill the law of love. And that we come together as persons, and every time we come together as persons, we bring our whole selves to the meeting, even if we're ignoring that and think we only bring our head and our ideas and our seat to endure. But the whole self is really present in any meeting, and the whole self needs to be addressed if you want to have some kind of community in that. So here are the crucial steps. First one, deciding who serves on a committee or a board. And I have to begin here because structurally this is where the problem is in many institutions. Is nomination to service on the board or committee done on the basis of getting people involved? Joe hasn't been involved lately. Let's get him involved. If you have the wrong kinds of motivations and processes for nominating people to serve on the board, you will get the wrong people on your board. And you will find those people very difficult to move because they came on the board for the wrong kinds of reasons. And they'll be very resistant to what you want. Is service on the board given in recognition of distinguishment in the community? Well, you know, we've got a millionaire, a bank president. Of course, he should be an elder in our congregation. Wrong. Is it given in recognition of wealth? This person is the biggest giver in our church, therefore they ought to be on the board. Or this is a very powerful person in our church, we better placate them by making sure they're on the board. Wrong. If those are the motivations that are driving the nomination process, everything else I'm going to talk to you is going to be real difficult because you're going to have the wrong people on the board. Service on a board or an elder or a deacon board should be given in response to a person's walk with the Lord and their demonstrated ministry. And I draw that from the biblical requirements for who serves. Presbyters are supposed to be apt to teach, for instance. How do you know that? Because they have demonstrated that in some way. The quality of their life, their faith in God, the quality of their family life, the spiritual characteristics that the person brings, these are things that nominating committees must be taught are the crucial factors. Then the whole issue of gifts is one that the typical nominating committee has never heard anything about. And people should be asked to serve based on the spiritual gifts that God has given them, so that you are matching a person that God has given a gift or ministry to with the committee or board function where that gift or ministry needs to be exercised. The one pattern would be, and in some cases it would be really hard, but I'm giving you the way that I think it needs to be, that no one should be nominated to serve on a board who has not ministered in a positive and helpful way in some ministry that indicates they have what it takes to serve as a spiritual leader in this congregation. So that no one gets nominated to be on a board that isn't down there in the ministry structure somewhere. Now, I think that's biblical. So that leadership for the board is emerging out of the ministry structure of the life of the church. It isn't the first place that you bring people in. Then, recruiting the board member. You don't even get a chance to do this if the nominating committee has nominated all the wrong people. But when you go to recruit, the typical recruiting speech is, would you serve? It won't take much time. We really need you. Appreciate it if you do this. That is the world's worst speech to give to get quality in ministry and community on the part of your board or committee. You need something else. You need clear job descriptions, first of all. What is it that you are asking this person to do? What ministry needs to be done by them? Do you know what the average job description, hidden job description is for an elder in a church? The job description is, come to as many meetings of the committee as you can manage in a year. Sit through the meeting for 2 hours. Go to the board when it meets all together in session and votes. That is your job description. Now, that's a functional job description. That is a terrible job description. That is guaranteed to get you bad results. If you want ministry from someone, you better have a conversation with them from what you're looking for. If you want prayer from them, that ought to be in their job description. If you want time between meetings and not just sitting in meetings as part of their job description, that ought to be in the job description. If you want certain kinds of results from the ministry, see, there's a big difference between sitting in a meeting and getting something done. See, if the job description is to get something done, not just to sit in the meeting, you need to make that clear when you're having the conversation. Now, can you see that that loops back to say, you have to have prayed, strategized, and thought that through before you get to the process. One of the things we have done with our session is we go, I'm going to tell you this in a few moments, to go on retreat. We go on retreat every year. And one of the things that we have done on one of our retreats, and then we recycle it, is that we had all of the elders write job descriptions for what it took to get the ministry done in their particular area of responsibility, which we then can share with new people who are being recruited. Here is what this ministry involves. Here is what it's going to take in order to accomplish the work of this ministry. Will you be able to do that? Then as part of recruiting, you want to express real care for the person and beware of telling and selling. This is one of those areas where you need to be listening. I had an elder of a key committee who simply didn't function well. It turned out that his job was a mess, his family was a mess, his life was a mess. And that man should never have been asked to serve. But he could squeeze out 2 hours a month. And so he had accepted. But nobody had taken the time to ask, how's your family? How's your marriage? How's your job right now? The guy tells you he's in a high demand time on his job and he's working 19 hours a day. You need to say, not, will you squeeze this in? But is that going to continue as you see it over the next period of time? Then probably this is not the best time. If the marriage is in trouble, or they're just not seeing much of each other, the guy jokes, you say, how's the marriage? Or it's a hurt. How's the marriage? Little joke, kind of smile, giggle, giggle. Well, we don't, it's great, I think, last time I had a chance to talk, and you really get a feeling that they're not seeing much of each other. You want to pay attention to that kind of stuff. You care for the person. That's a primary message. You don't just care to fill a job. You're not just putting a body in a slot, So this is a pastoral kind of conversation. How are you doing spiritually? Some of our churches would faint. In fact, in one church, when they decided that they would ask the question of prospective elders as part of the recruiting conversation, how they're doing spiritually, one person responding said, quote, it's none of your damn business. Oh? And the idea was, what's that got to do with anything? Now, immediately, that person should have been disqualified from being an elder. They were selected to be on the board. The person was so intimidated, it was kind of like, well, really, I guess we're not supposed to ask each other how we're doing spiritually. And they backed way off, And instead, when someone says, well, I don't know that I want to talk about that, that's a problem, right there. Then, exploration of possibilities. In every conversation, you have to consider that if not now, maybe later. And some of these conversations are not recruiting somebody for today. My best people have been recruited in conversations in which, as I listen to their concerns, I will say to them, this doesn't sound like it's a good thing for you to be doing right now. How about if I come back in 6 months or in a year? If you have a long-term commitment to your church and a long-term strategy, then you can do that kind of thing. If you're always putting out fires, it's difficult to do that kind of thing. But then you come back. And many times people have gotten their lives together and they're ready. And the kind of commitment that they'll make is substantial and real when you do that. Another principle in recruiting is a delayed decision. I personally follow the philosophy of never let somebody answer me on the first conversation. Because, I don't know about you, but I have some ability to manipulate people. And I have learned that people that I manipulate into jobs do not have a sense of call from God. They have a sense of having done it out of loyalty to me. I don't want things done out of loyalty to me. I want them to know that God has called them to this ministry. So I say, here's what it's going to take. Here's the work involved. Here are the kind of commitments we're asking for. Let's pray about it, and I will give you a call or talk to you next week. lots of times people give me a preliminary answer, and I will say, go home and talk to your spouse. Think about that. And every once in a while, they come back and say, you know, I thought about that. I've made it, and it's not a good thing to do. And I've made it easy for them to say no, so that they're not feeling coerced. Most of the time, they say yes, but they feel good about the yes, because it was thought about, prayed about it. They had a little room to maneuver. All of these are principles, by the way, that come out of group dynamics. Can you see how they do? That you're giving people freedom, room to move around, room to choose, room to buy in. When they do that, they commit in a different way. So that's why it's worth the time and energy here. A sense of high calling needs to be conveyed. And for me, it boils down like this. We're not asking you to do a job. We're asking you to consider a ministry. There's a difference between a job and a ministry. A ministry is something that I do because I believe God has called me to it. And I am willing then to pay the prices of ministry. So a key question is this something God is calling you to? I know I'm bringing you the request, but is this a question that God, is this something that God is calling you to? Then you need to ask, what help will you need to fulfill the job expectation? What, and then tell them what help and training is available. And don't do the standard thing where you say, oh, we'll give you all the help in the world. And they never see you again. So you listen, and you plan, and you develop some training things. What kind of support will be given? I was working with a couple that I had, I needed the potluck dinner group coordinators. We had 18 potluck dinner groups going. The previous coordinator had resigned. And I needed a new coordinator. I started praying about who those people should be. And finally, it was several months, and finally a certain couple came very strongly to mind, and I saw them and said, hey, I want to talk to you about something. There's a ministry that I think might be the right ministry. Could you come over to my house and we'll talk about it? And they came over to the house. They sat on a couch, and we had this conversation, and I had to say to them, basically, the ministry is you will be the pastor to a flock of about 200 people. And there are almost no resources available, and I'm going to be able to give you very little time, because right at the moment, I'm doing this, I'm doing this, and I'm doing this. This is what I can give you, and you'll have that, but it's limited, and you're basically going to be doing this kind of thing, so this is going to be tough. Here are the rewards. Here's what God could do through this kind of a ministry, but it's going to cost you. Now, pray and think about it. Well, and we were going back and forth, but when I got to the end of my speech, he looked at her, and she looked at him, and they smiled. And I said, okay, what's that smile about? It was one of those funny kinds of smiles. And he said, when the car on the way over here, we said to each other, if this is another one of those Mickey Mouse church jobs, we don't want it. And they were hungry for something significant to do. And they functioned for over 8 years in that particular pastoral ministry in the church. When we talk people into things, we're constantly having to recruit. When God calls them into things, sometimes they find that's their whole life, you know, and a ministry that God is really giving them. Then, the first training experience. Here is very important that you set new norms for how you're going to function as a committee or as a board. And this needs to be in the recruiting job description. But part of this job description is that we expect you to be trained, and that we have a training design as part of the requirements for this office. In our church, we require all of the elders to participate in 4 weeks of training before they come on the board. And in that training experience, you set new norms, and you do relationship building, you use sharing questions, you pray conversationally with each other, you share task definitions, and you send a message. We care for each other as we do the work of ministry. We are committed to each other as well as to the work that God has given us to do together. Part of the training then can be how to build relationships in your committee. We rotate elders every 3 years. Over a 3-year training pattern, if every new elder is trained in this new model, you can revitalize your session by the end of the 3 years because you have trained them in a new kind of pattern. Then the next major thing is that you need a yearly retreat for your committee or your board. And I really recommend this if you want committees to function as communities, that every committee that's willing and open has a yearly retreat, at least a Friday night and Saturday. A 3-day away is better. But that retreat can be done if you've got no money in your small church, you can do it in somebody's home. and meet on Friday night and Saturday. You don't have to go away in order to have this kind of an experience. But you schedule in an extended period of time with each other. Committee structures, 2 hours once a month, or board meetings, 2 to 8 hours once a month, are destructive of building relationships. You don't have enough time. It also isn't good for problem solving. The typical committee that meets for 2 hours has only enough time to work through the first stage of the problem solving process. What is the problem? They don't have enough time to do good process to work through how to solve the problem. And if you've got a major issue to work on, well, you need to have the kinds of relationships and time where you can work on that. So you take the board, and I'll give you 2 examples. Our session goes on retreat every December. And if you cannot make the retreat, that is a sign that God is not calling you to be on the session. The retreat is a required part of what it means to be on the session. And we're a low-demand church. But at this point, we have found that high demand has to be there. Because in the retreat, then, we spend a large amount of time building relationships, sharing vision, working together in teams, and we also do goal setting. So there's a lot of tasks that's done in the retreat. We set our goals for the next year. We use management by objectives kinds of principles. We teach them to all the committee members. They evaluate last year. They set goals for the next year. But they spend time getting to know each other. They pray for each other. We survive through the year off of the relationships in that retreat. Yeah. That really holds us, you know, together as one decision-making team. In the Adult Education Committee, which is one that over the years I have worked with very intensely in churches, we try to have a retreat in May and either go away or be in a home in which we can spend a serious amount of time with each other and spend at least 4 hours at different times in relationship building and prayer kinds of times together. And then we take a major area of the church's life and we brainstorm and pray together about how we want to tackle that. Family life ministry might be the subject for 1 year. You know, small groups might be the subject for another year. And we take enough time to work through that problem all of the way. But you need fun time, you need food, you need a relaxed time, but you need good task work and good relationship things. You're setting new models for coming at that. Then in your regular meetings, you need to try and build a regular pattern in which you do some sharing and prayer as part of every meeting time. And you don't have to take hours to do this. You can subgroup people into twos. And you can have them share with each other for 5 minutes what's one concern that you have that we can pray for. And then have a time of prayer in your session. You can subgroup into fours and give them 15 minutes and have them work on something. Now, but here's the principle. If you are changing from an institutional to a more relational kind of church, the sharing questions should be related to the task of the group. Sharing questions for an evangelism committee, for instance, would be, when did you come to faith and what was most helpful for you in that process? So that task-oriented types aren't real good on touchy-feely sharing questions. You want to ask them sharing questions that are related enough to the task worship committee. What's the most important experience of worship that you ever had in your life and what went into that? Well, so that they're sharing, and it's personal, but they're sharing around the task. Christian Education Committee, what do you remember about being a child in church, in a church school? You know, was that good, bad, or indifferent? What do you remember about that? And people are sharing, but you're also gathering information that's going to help you when you come to decision-making. Easter planning for the Lenten season. What's the significance of Easter for you, personally? You know, those kinds of things. Sharing questions around the task. Two things more on that. It is a general principle that if you spend some time in sharing at the beginning of a meeting, the speeches later on in the meeting will be briefer. And you do not actually extend the time of meeting, you shorten it, because everyone has a need to make a speech. If they've had a chance to make that speech in a sharing time where they've been prayed for, where there's a sense of care, they very often do not have to work out their frustrations, their anger, their hurt or their disappointment in the speeches that they're making on the floor of session. When we first introduced this into one large session, I was told this would never work. Our session meetings were going past 11 o'clock every night. It was kind of, you hated to go because you never knew when you were going to get home, and we had hassles and hassles and hassles and hassles. And we started doing the sharing, and the session meetings dropped down in length, and we were done before 10 o'clock every time. It was just amazing that when people felt cared for, they could participate in a different kind of way in what is going on. But there's one other proviso that goes with this. You've got to know how to plan a good meeting so that when you come to the agenda setting and problem solving and discussions, you're doing that efficiently. That's why these management principles and some of these other things are so important. If you run a sloppy meeting and you add sharing to it, what people will say is, we don't have time for the sharing. So you have to learn how to run an efficient meeting that focuses on the things you really need to focus on and knows how to move along in the process and does enough homework ahead of time so that you're ready, you know, when you come to that particular discussion. Otherwise, every time, an institutionally task-oriented group of people will say, well, what has to go is the sharing of prayer. We don't have time for that. And so you got to do those two things simultaneously, or you don't have a whisper of a chance here. The last couple of points I want to mention in terms of committees or boards moving into communities is that in your committees, you can't do this in your boards, if you only have elected elders or deacons or whatever on your committees, consider expanded committees and put lay people on those committees alongside of the elected elders. The elder usually serves as a chairperson of the committee, but put lay people. This is the laboratory for future leadership. And I've seen so many churches just have their committees all made up of just the elders, and that's devastating because new life is coming through those lay people and future elders are coming through those lay people. So consider you've got three people on the worship committee, put nine lay people alongside of them and work together as a ministry team in the area of worship. You have more person power in order to get tasks done. You've got a team that you can work with. Now, so consider expanded committees. And then the pastor's care for the people. I have written of an experience I had with an elder in our church that I asked to go to lunch. And after we had had our lunch, he leaned back and he said, now, what is it you want? And I said, I don't want anything. I just want to hear how you're doing and how things are going and have a chance for us to talk. And I said, oh, come on. He says, I have never been to lunch with a pastor that he didn't want something. And we think people can't read us. Do you have any time with your key leaders in which they are the agenda and not the job, not their performance, where you are simply interested in them, listening, not talking about how to solve a problem, not lobbying them to support your position on this or that issue, but where you're asking not how is the work going, but how are you doing, in which you express affirmation not just for their performance in the job, but for them as a person and what you appreciate about them. Caring, listening, relationship time between meetings makes all the difference in what happens in a meeting. Part of that, for me, also comes down to the issue of, do you ever get on their territory where they are the ones in control? Do you go to their offices? Do you sit in their home? Or do you only have the conversations on your territory where you're the power figure? Are you a listening, caring, supportive person? One of the rewards that we have to give to leadership is our time. And if we only use that time instrumentally, people will feel that they are being used. If we use some of that time more personally, people appreciate that. They know the difference. And you don't have the kind of thing which is typical in many churches, and I have interviewed hundreds of elders and asked them how they felt about being an elder. And the average response has been, I'll be so glad when this term of office is over. The right response will be, I will be sorry when this particular form of ministry has to cease. And people ought to come off of their term of office more committed, more encouraged, more supportive than when they started. And if they are not, then we are not doing the right thing in terms of working with them. I want, our time is up, to just say a few things to you in by way of summary. One of the things that I said to you on the first day of class was that there is no way that you cannot learn from any group experience if you bring to that experience the kind of teachability and openness to see what it is that God wants to teach you in the worst committee, in the toughest conflict, in the most dull and boring of groups. There is something that God can teach you if you will bring that kind of attitude to that situation. And if I might just speak to one theme I heard in two of the groups that I was listening to this morning, that for many of us as leaders, there is this on-off kind of orientation which says that when we are the designated or formal leader, we know what to do. And we're quite active and assertive and functioning in multiple roles when it's our turn to be the leader. For many of us, when we are not the leader is when we do not know what to do. We either have to take over the group or be passive in the group, or relatively passive. If I could suggest a specific behavior or a skill area for many of us to work on in our future group experiences, it would be to say that when you are in a group and you are not the leader, that is your opportunity to choose a function. Summary, energizing, tension relieving, encouragement, opinion asking, that is not the normal thing that you are doing. And be active and putting out energy in a group. One of the most destructive things in groups is when no one puts out energy except the leader. And we as leaders need to know that the quality of the group that you are in can be enormously improved if you will put out energy every time you're in that group situation, whether or not you are the leader. And that's a place where you can practice different kinds of functionings and try out new behaviors. When you're the designated leader, it's harder because the functions are more laid out for you. They have to be done. It's when you're not the designated leader that you have the most opportunity to learn. So I would encourage you to seek out those kinds of situations, and when you're in them, to see them as primary opportunities to apply new behaviors, to sharpen skills, to be working on particular kinds of things. The last thing that I want to say to you is that you cannot fail in this ministry in any ultimate sense, because this is a work that God is doing in his people. There are things that we do that are really not in accord with the will of God, and they're uphill and hard. When we do this, we need to know that this is the flow of the Spirit to build the church. And that when things are hard, they are hard because God wants to do something deep and lasting and significant. And we take our encouragement not from our own skill proficiency. That isn't the fundamental source of our encouragement in this area. It isn't because we've mastered certain textbooks, or we've had certain kinds of techniques, or we know certain kinds of routines. Our basic encouragement for this work is that Jesus has promised that he will build his church. And he has chosen to use humans, us, as part of that process of building his church. And that he works through us by his Spirit in order to enable that. So that when I get discouraged with myself, or with my people, or with the structures, or the situations, I have to come back to home base. And home base is to remember that this church is God's. It's not mine. And he cares about building it and trusting his work in me and in the people and in the situation. Exercising faith, living in the power of the Spirit, making myself available to him without being unduly reliant on my own messianic abilities, gives me the kind of rest that makes possible forward movement in this particular area.